Coming up next on the Witness the World podcast. If there's a will, there's a way.
The subconscious mind never says no to you. If you say, I want to do a business, consciously you believe in it. The subconscious mind says, yeah, why not? Let's go. It not just says, let's go. It tries to encourage you to do that. And it creates stories for you. Yeah, you have a big store. You have a successful business. You have you dream at night. If it comes in your dreams, it is trying to encourage you to do that. But till you get into trouble. It's not the subconscious mind that gets you in trouble. It's you who get yourself in trouble.
The Witness the World podcast represents the personal views of the host and guests at the time of recording. These views may change over time. The content here is for informational and entertainment purposes only. Any content here should not be construed as financial, medical, or any other type of professional advice. Please consult with a qualified practitioner should you require any professional advice. Good day, everyone. Welcome to episode 10 of the Witness the World podcast. My name is Ben Choi, and today we'll be heading to Eastern Canada. Our guest has battled through many challenges from day one. He grew up in Afghanistan and struggled with paralysis and to survive every day. He later found his way and literally got back on his feet and now works to help others with their personal challenges. He has authored 2 books and is also working on a project to help improve childhood education in Afghanistan. Today, we'll learn about his transformation and explore his approach to breaking free from adversity while channeling his experiences and converting it to success. Mehdi Akberi, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Ben. I'm so glad to be here.
Thanks so much. So, Mehdi, to kick things off, I thought it would be great to hear a bit about your origin story. To say adversity struck you from day one would be a bit of an understatement. So could you please take us back to your roots to kick things off?
Yeah, definitely. I was born in Afghanistan, in central Afghanistan, one of the poorest part of the country. At 1973, October 30, 1973. When I was born, I was paralyzed. I was told that I would never be able to walk. So that's how the first thing I remember, that I just wanted to walk, and why can't I walk? And that was the first thing that I can remember asking my parents, why can't I walk? Why can't I walk? It was poverty was so much that people had a hard time feeding themselves, and we didn't know any other world existed beyond the mountains. So we were surrounded by high mountains, and we thought that behind these mountains there is nothing. That's how isolated we were, and then that's how isolated that village that I was born.
So very different circumstances from Canada when you grow up and living in Afghanistan. So I wonder, Mehdi, could you like share with our audience like what like a regular day was like, you know, living in Afghanistan? I mean, let alone dealing with paralysis, but like just what was it like for you and for the people there?
People relied on farming. That's the only source of income they had, and they struggled on a regular basis, just like any poor country now that you can imagine. Everybody had to work from morning to evening, try to cultivate mainly wheat and turn them into flour, into the bread. If people had enough bread for the winter, for example, and maybe a few livestock, then they were happy. They were happy. There was no electricity, no telephone, no TV. We even didn't know that electricity existed. So it was hard for me personally. I just wanted to know why I couldn't walk. So for me, it was really hard because I couldn't move. My parents had to take me. If I ever got lucky to be outside, they would just put me outside in front of the house and always warn me, don't move off the blanket that I was on. So for me, it was a lot more challenging than other kids because I couldn't move. I couldn't go anywhere.
I see. So at what point, like, were you able to, you know, start that recovery process? I mean, I can't even imagine, you know, I'm not fortunate to be able to walk, you know, all my life, but, yeah. You know, being a kid, thinking that you just can't move and that was a way of life. I mean, how did you manage that? It sounded like it was quite a challenge.
After a while, you kind of accept, right? You, and since everybody keeps telling you that that's your fate, that's what God wanted. So, and because people were really religious, and they said that's what I heard, it's God's will, that's all, you have to accept it. And after a while, you do, you say, okay, I guess this is it. But one day when I was outside on this blanket that my mom made for me, my brother forgot his knife next to me, and I took the knife and I took a piece of wood and I was just playing with it, trying to make something out of it. And accidentally, it slipped and I cut my index finger to the bone. And I was scared that my mom would punish me. So I just kind of held it tight. And I cut a little bit of that blanket thing and I wrapped around my finger. And I kept hiding it from my mom. But next day, the bleeding stopped. So, I was kind of wondering how come the bleeding stopped. So I opened it and I saw it was hard a little bit. And then I was wondering what it was. And then the next day, it got better. The next day, it got better. After a week, after 2 weeks, I realized that it healed itself. And that's when I was curious, how did it happen? Who did it? And I went to my mom and says, who, you know, I cut my fingers and who fixed it? And she said, it was God. And I thought for a while, I said, okay, it's God. And then one day I watched my mom pray as usual. And after praying, she would always pray, oh, God, give me this, God, do this, God, do that. And then I realized that I never asked God to do anything for me, especially for this cut. I never asked God. Nobody prayed God. How does God know that I cut myself? And then I told my mom, I don't think it is God. And she got mad at me and said, never, never, ever question God. But inside me, I thought there was something inside me. There's something that fix this cut. If that thing can fix the cut, I'm sure it can help me to learn how to walk. It can fix my legs. And that's when all the questions start. Okay, how can I talk to it? How can it help me do it? And I keep asking myself, how? And then I thought, maybe I should talk to it. Whatever it is inside me, maybe I'll talk. And I start talking to myself. Okay, come on, please. I know you can hear me. If you can fix the wound, the cut, you can obviously fix my legs. Come on, please do that. And I keep doing that for days and weeks and months. And my parents were even more worried now. They thought that I was going crazy. So nothing happened. And then I thought, okay, now what? Then I thought, okay, maybe he doesn't understand me. Just a child. And then maybe I should massage my legs, you know, maybe it'll understand me and talk to it. And I kept massaging and talking it. And I did that for months. That didn't work. And then one day I realized that, oh, maybe it doesn't understand anything. Maybe it wants me to show it what I want from it. As long as somebody can hold me up, that I could actually try to walk, maybe it'll understand what I'm trying to do. And then I'll just beg my mom, my dad, my brother, somebody can please hold me up, you know, that I just want to walk. And they would say, why? I said, I just want to learn how to walk. And they would laugh at me and says, you know, after a while, they got tired of me. Nobody listened to me. So well, let me know if I'm going too far, because
no, that's great. That's great, Mehdi. So I'm just trying to conceptualize this. So how old were you when you started getting this thought process and then started those babies? Like, I guess you're taking baby steps, I guess, mentally, and then you're trying to urge your muscles to start activating. So sorry, what age did you start like this whole process?
When I cut my finger, I was about 5 years old. You know, for about a year, I kept trying to figure out what to do. And when I was six, then I realized that, okay, maybe I should try to stand on my feet and walk. And since nobody believed me, nobody helped me, I had to find a way to stand on my feet, because every single night I dreamed of running around, playing with other kids and doing all this kid stuff. And the morning when I woke up and find myself like that, it even, you know, it drove me even more. Come on, you can do that. So the first thing that I thought that could help me to stand on my feet was the door handle. And I approached the first door trying to stand up, and I realized that I couldn't even move a little bit. Didn't give up. I kept trying until I broke the door handle, and then I was punished for that. And anything that I could find in the room, I tried to hold on to and stand up, and I kind of broke everything, you know, every time, and things fell on me, and I had bruises all the time, and I was punished all the time, yelled at all the time to stop it. But that was the only option I had. Then I convinced my brother to build me something outside. You guys don't let me do anything inside. Just build me something outside. So we come up an idea of like those gymnast bar, the two bars. So I convinced my brother to build me one outside, and he built me one outside. And I thought I could use my both hands and stand on my feet. And I realized that I couldn't do that either. And I would ask everybody else, come on, please hold me up. And for a while they did. And then after that, they quit. You know, then I came up another idea to create a couple steps that I could sit on it and then try to sit on it, and that I could be high enough to stand on my feet. And I couldn't do that. And I kept trying and trying and trying till I was 7 years old. I did that for 2 years. And I wouldn't sit anywhere but between those two bars. In the morning when I woke up, I begged my mom to put me between those two bars. And I would eat there, I would drink there, and I'll try to stand up. And I had bruises all the time. I probably fell a million times in those 2 years. When I was about 7 years old, I felt pain in my knee. And that was the first time I felt something. And the next day, I felt like I moved my toe. And that's how everything started. And from there, it took me about another year or so to be able to take baby steps.
Wow, that's an amazing, you know, evolution there for your walking there, Mehdi. So what did your parents say to you when you started moving? I guess you proved them wrong. And were they just, I guess, flabbergasted? They just didn't know what to say, I guess.
Well, they were obviously thrilled. For people back, you know, they were very simple people, you know, very religious, and everything had to be God. So it was God. So it was simple. It's God did it. God helped you. God changed his mind. And there you go. You know, but for me, it didn't really matter who did it, as long as I could walk.
Interesting. Yeah, that's a great story there, Mehdi. Yeah. So let's kind of turn to, you know, growing up a little further now. So Afghanistan, obviously very challenging conditions for anyone to live. And some of the stuff I was reading up on you, you kind of fled to Pakistan later. And I think you're a little bit older at that point. Maybe you can just kind of share a little bit about, you know, like what happened there, how you guys kind of transitioned over, and what was that like?
Well, just to before we get there, you know, because I couldn't go anywhere, right? I couldn't move when I was 5 years old. I had to keep myself busy, and question was all I had. I would ask questions from everybody who pass me by, you know, my parents. I would watch them fight, for example, and I would ask them, why do you fight? Why don't you do this? Why don't you do that? Why don't we grow more chickens, for example, that we could have chicken eggs every morning instead of once a month? You know, why don't we do this? Why don't we do that? And I would come up with solutions that nobody listened, but I had that kept me going. And when I finally, when I could walk, I put everything in practice. You know, I would do stuff that people never thought of, and you know, and people didn't like it. But I kept doing stuff that was out of the box. You know, and I'd ask questions before I ask question my family question. Now I'll just go ask my neighbors, ask everybody else the question. Why do you do this? Why is this happening? Why is that? Why is that? One of the incidents that actually changed my life, my young life, is there was no schools. So my parents put me, when I was 8 and a half or 9 years old, they put me in a religious school and in a mosque, say, just go study Quran, the holy book. But I couldn't. I couldn't memorize it. You have to memorize it. And it was in a different language, in Arabic. It was not even in our language, in Persian. It was in Arabic. And I had no idea what it meant. And all I had to do was memorize it. But I couldn't do that. And the teacher, the mullah, punished me on a regular basis. They beat me up on a regular basis because I couldn't learn. So one day I found a Quran with a translation in Persian. I knew a little bit Persian because my brother taught me, and I could read it. And I said, oh, great. Now, why don't mullah teach me in Farsi and Persian so that I could understand? But I didn't know that. Well, that was an out-of-the-box question. That's against religion. You have to study Quran in Arabic. So, and when I actually asked mullah, and I was punished really badly. And from that day on, I said, I'm not going to study. I'm not going to go to the mosque at all. No matter how much they punished me, I said no. And I said, I'll only do what I believe is right. I don't care what happens to me. And for that, if I had to, and they, I was punished to the point where when I was about 9 or so years old, I left home. I ran away. I went to the mountain. I was lost for 2 nights, almost died before they found me. So it changed me. It changed me in a way that nothing people did made sense. The way they lived didn't make sense. You know, the way they approach stuff didn't make sense. So I questioned everything from a young age, and they called me grandpa. My parents used to call me grandpa. I said, because you ask questions that a child shouldn't ask. So I was a troubled kid, basically, for my parents. When I was about 11 years old, when Soviet invaded Afghanistan, the war started, and it was getting worse and worse. And that's when my parents decided to flee to Pakistan.
Yeah, it's quite, you know, an interesting kind of path on, you know, how you kind of evolved. Like, it's almost like if you didn't have that paralysis happening, all these different things in your life just probably wouldn't have happened. And you know, the critical thinking outside the box, and everything where you are today, which we'll get to. So so then when you went to Pakistan, that was like your whole family, you guys just resettled and try to start over. That was, I guess, that was probably the plan for a lot of people back then.
Yeah, exactly. You want anywhere to save, basically. So I had we were 5 brothers, 2 sisters. My brother, when I was 11, my brother married and they had a daughter. So we're a big family. When we were fleeing to Pakistan, so we rented 2 vehicles. Me, my 2 brothers, and some other passengers were in 1 vehicle. My father, my parents, and my siblings, and my brother's wife and their daughter was another vehicle. Unfortunately, their vehicle went over a landmine. Everybody got killed except my father and the driver while trying to flee Pakistan. So the only me, my 2 brothers, and my father were the only survivors.
Wow, that's really tragic. And it's probably, you know, happened to a lot of families on that treacherous journey, I would imagine. So
yeah, unfortunately. So that was another turning point, you know, and as 11 years old, and I thought, because I was so close to my brothers, I thought I lost everything. So my younger brothers, my sisters, they were the only ones that I you know, were very attached to. That was a really turning point in my life. When we went to Pakistan for the first time, I saw electricity, I saw cars, I saw TV, all fridge, for example, and I was surprised that this stuff even existed. I thought we were in a different world, but it was really exciting for me, just wow, now I can explore. As an 11-year-old, and I just wanted to know what I need to do. I didn't want to go to school, though they put me in school, even if in Afghanistan, after I refused to go to this religious school, they put me, there was an NGO school, they opened an NGO school, they sent me to that school. So and they accepted me in grade 4. And my first day there, when I went there, and the teacher was talking about how wind is created, and he said water creates wind. And I was curious. I said, wow, that's great. And then I said, okay, next page. And then I raised my hand. Excuse me, sir, how does water create wind? If I take a bowl of water in my room, will it create wind? And he said, no, it's not like that. We'll get to that. I said, no, please, I really want to know. He says, oh, no, next page. I said, come on, please. I really want to know. I won't be able to sleep if I wouldn't know this. Then he said, come here, my son. Then I went in front of this class and he patted my back and said, oh, you're the smartest student here. And then he announced to the rest of the students that from now on, Mehdi is the head student. If I'm not around, everybody has to listen to him. And then I went home and I told my parents, I'm not going to go to that school anymore. They said, what do you mean? I said, well, the teacher doesn't know anything. Oh my God. Imagine talking like that to your parents. And they were mad. So, and you know everything. The mullah doesn't know anything. The teacher don't know anything. We don't know anything. And you're an 8-year-old, you know everything. So when something didn't click, I didn't want to do it. So even if when we went to Pakistan, the same thing, I just want to know, why am I here? What is this? All this question from a very young age, it was odd for a lot of people, to the point where my father, they left me alone. They said, well, it is useless talking to you. Stuff that you're saying doesn't make any sense. Just stay, as long as you stay at home, be back at night, we're fine. And then I thought, what do I need to do? And then I said, well, if Pakistan is like this, how about the rest of the world? So I said, I want to travel. I want to travel the world. And the first person that I could tell was obviously my family. I told my father, I want to travel the world. And he yelled and screamed at me, get out of here. We don't have enough money to feed ourselves and you want to travel the world. But I said, I'm going to travel the world. How? I don't know. Everybody asked me, how are you going to do that? I don't know. After about a year in Pakistan, they admitted me to a school there, an NGO school in Pakistan. And they admitted me at grade 4 because of language barriers. I asked the teacher, when can I travel? If I study at school, when can I start traveling? She ignored me. And I said again and again, till I bothered her so much. I was so annoying to her that she took me to the principal's office. And I asked the principal, when can I travel if I study here? So she was really a nice lady. And she talked to me and she said, okay, well, if you do this, if you do that, study, go to school, go to college, go to university, and then get this job. When you're about 40 or so years old, maybe if you have a good job, you'll be able to travel. I said, what? Really? I said, yeah. I said, I'm not coming to the school anymore because I want to travel today. And I didn't go to school from that day, but I wanted to travel the world and explore.
And that's actually my next question. It's like with limited means and obviously with the school thing I didn't know about here, like, yeah, how did you manage to travel the world?
I hope I'm not jumping ahead. What most people, when we tell most people, 99% of the people that you wanted, you're an 8-year-old, you tell the 99% of the people you want to travel, or 11-year-old, you want to travel the world, to them, it is crazy, because it only makes sense. How can you travel, right? You're only 11 years old. You don't have, you're a minor. You don't have a passport. You don't know the language. You're a refugee, for God's sake. How can you travel? But fortunately, that's not how the mind works. But I didn't know this stuff. I just did it. And I just wanted to travel. Every time I wanted to do something, I said, I want to travel. That's all I wanted. What is the next step? How? It never occurred to me to ask that question. How? I said, I don't know, but I do want to travel. If this thing inside me can fix this cut and can fix my legs, I am sure it'll find me a way how to travel. I just put it in my head. I want to travel. And I would tell everybody. I would tell the neighbors I want to travel. I would tell a passerby I want to travel. And then I would find tourists and I would go try to talk to them, though I didn't understand the language. And my neighbor, we had a really nice neighbor. This lady was a dog, a teacher. And she laughed at me and she said, well, if you want to travel the world, you have to learn English. I said, well, what is that? We said, it's an international language. You have to learn English. I said, oh, okay, there you go. I'm going to learn English. And I told my father I want to learn English. And he obviously got mad at me because I had to go to a course and wanted to pay. Nobody wanted to pay. And I said, okay, well, that's out of the question. So how can I learn English? And then my neighbor, the lady who said you need to learn English, she had nine children, all were boys. And she was a teacher. She would teach them at home as well. And I went and told her, can you please teach me English? She said, I don't know. I already have nine here. I said, okay, please, come on. You have nine. What is one more? You know? And then I convinced her to teach me English. And she gave me a book, A, B, C, D, A for apple, B for boy, C for cat. And I was mesmerized. You know, wow, this is a different language. Great. And because I didn't go to school, I would study all day long, A for apple, A-P-P-L-E, apple. You know, I would study and study. After a few months, and she said, well, I'm sorry, I don't know English. This is all I knew. Okay, so I can't teach you anymore. And then I thought, well, if one neighbor can teach me, I'm sure I can find someone else to teach me. And then I kept looking at, I kept knocking on doors. And that was crazy, but I didn't care. I kept knocking on doors and everybody was like, get out of here. Most people thought I was a beggar or something and they would, you know, yell and scream at me, but I would still go knock on doors and try to introduce myself. One neighbor who was right in front of us, really nice couple, both were doctors, husband and wife were doctors. They had three children, two boys and a girl. And every now and then I saw them sitting in the balcony teaching their children. I asked them three times, they refused. Said, well, I can't do that. But they were nice. You know, they refused nicely. Oh, no, I'm sorry, my son, I can't do that. And so it made me go back to them again and again and again and again till they said yes. You know, and reluctantly said yes. Reluctantly, they said yes. They told me, as long as you don't ask much questions, as long as you don't bother us, as long as you're only here when we teach our children. I said, fine. And I went there and I started learning English from them. And after about 2 years, I didn't just learn English. I wanted to know how to speak properly. Like if you listen to a Pakistani accent or Indian accent, they have a very heavy accent. Like, what the hell are you talking about? Right? Something like that. And that's how that was normal. But I didn't want to talk like that. I said, okay, I want to talk a little bit different, maybe just like an English speaking person. So I found Full House. you know, the show Full House. DJ was my best girl. So, you know, I would record her voice and try to imitate how she speaks and all that. So after 2 years, they didn't, you know, the doctor and his wife was amazed at how I improved and how I spoke English. So that's how I start English. So that's the first phase. Okay, so now I still want to travel, but how? But I didn't care. I didn't know. Till one day I was watching Boris Becker and Ivan Lendl playing in the Wimbledon final. I think it was in 1986 or 85. And the commentator was talking about Ivan Lendl. I think he was 16 at that time, that how he travels the world and how much money he makes and all that stuff. I didn't care much about the money, but the traveling part interested me. I said, oh, wow, I want to play tennis. I want to travel like Ivan Lendl. And I told everybody that I want to play tennis. And I told the doctor that I want to play tennis. And doctor laughed at me and said, here, come here, my son. Sit down here. I'm a doctor. My wife is a doctor. We cannot afford to play tennis in this country. Forget about it. So I told my brother and my father I want to play tennis. And they even don't know what tennis was. I didn't know what tennis was till I saw that day either. And my brother was, okay, just go play outside, whatever you want to play. You want to play tennis, go play outside. They didn't know what it was. But I just wanted to play tennis. And what do I need for tennis? A racket. That's all. Now the next step was get a racket. Where do I play? I don't know. I want a racket. And I would go find this sports shops, go and look into rackets all the time and pick it up and try to, you know, swing it and all that stuff. And then I would come home. I knew because I couldn't afford it. But I would dream every night that I'm playing tennis and I'm traveling the world and all that. And I realized that nobody's buying me. So I said, I'm going to, one day I decided to go on hunger strike, you know? So I told my brother that I'm not, you know, you guys don't love me anymore. You know, if my younger brother was here, I kind of blackmailed them, you know, emotionally, that if my younger brothers were here, I would play with them. Nobody loves me and all that. And I would cry, you know, all I want is a tennis racket. And After a month or two of back and forth and hunger strike and all that stuff, and I finally convinced him to buy me a tennis racket. So a wooden tennis racket, my first tennis racket. And he would ask me, what do you play? What do you want to play? I said, I don't know. Who do you want to play with? I don't know. I just want a racket. And Ben, it's really a long story. I don't know if you want to drag it on.
I think this is good. You know, the thing that I think about when I hear your story is, like, I don't know if you know the saying, if there's a will, there's a way.
Yeah.
I think this is the story of your life thus far. So we haven't got to the rest of it yet. But so maybe you can kind of, from the tennis, that will to, you know, find a way to kind of do what you want to do and go where you want to go. So on the traveling aspect, maybe you can just kind of, you know, touch on, like, how did you kind of facilitate your travels around the world?
I did manage to play tennis. I played tennis in a naval complex where all the brigadiers and generals and all the officers and their children played. I kind of pretended that I'm the son of an officer, and I played in that club for 8 months without anybody realizing that I was an outsider. So, within that 8 months, I found out a library, an American library in Islamabad, Pakistan, where I could actually watch tennis on TV. And they had instruction VHS and that I could go and watch and all that. And I improved my tennis, and I was the best tennis player and that club in 8 months. And then that's how they noticed me, and they asked me questions, and that's how they kicked me out of there. And so, but I played another club. We moved to another city, and I started playing tennis in another club because they wouldn't allow civilians were not allowed to play at this kind of clubs, because there were very few civilian clubs for ordinary people. So I had to go to this army or naval clubs. So I went to another one, but I proved to them that I'm worth giving a chance. So I showed them how well I play tennis, and the manager of that club saw my tennis and he was impressed. But when I told him I want to travel the world and I'm using tennis as an instrument to travel the world, he said, you know, my son, you should play squash, because tennis, there is no tennis player in Pakistan. So, but there are, we have two world champions in squash. If you play squash, there's always room for you to improve. And then I started squash. And 9 months, I was number two in the province in squash. And then I became eligible to be in Pakistani junior team. And I became part of the junior team. And that's how I started traveling the world when I was 16 years old.
Ah, I see.
That was the beginning. That was the beginning.
That it all connects now there, Mehdi. Okay, yeah. Perfect. You know, that's a great story there. And yeah, you got a lot of detail there. And I think that's terrific. So in your travels, let's fast forward a little bit. You eventually, you know, found your way to Canada when you were growing up. And maybe you can just tell us a little bit about, you know, why Canada, now that you have, you know, settled in and dug in and got a lot of roots in Canada now. What was the decision like, and how did it come to be for you?
Well, I unfortunately my squash career didn't last very long, because I injured my knee when I was 17 and a half years old. So that didn't last very long. And then when that ended, and I said, I still want to travel. I didn't have any money. I remember that I had only $100, and I said, okay, I'm out of the house. I'm going to travel, because I had a hard time with my family, because just like I said, I was, everything I did was out of the box. Everything, my thoughts, my actions, my behavior, everything was out of the box. I didn't fit at all. With $100 in my pocket when I was 17 years old, I left home. I traveled for the next five years. I just backpacked half a dozen countries, and after about five or so years, I ended up in New York. And I lived in Chicago, I lived in New York, I live in Atlanta, and then I moved to Toronto, which I really liked it here, and that's how I settled in Toronto. It was 1993 or 94. Yeah, 94.
I see. Yeah, thanks for the travel journey there, Mehdi. So now that you got to Canada, you know, it just sounds like, you know, with your approach and mindset, you know, business was something that you found to be your calling, and it seemed like a natural for someone that thinks outside the box, and that's kind of what you're into now. And I wonder if you could just kind of share a little bit about, the work that you do now and the business side of things, and let's hear a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, I got into business because I had no other options, right? I could, when I got here, I realized that during my travel, especially backpacking, I taught English. Wherever I went, I taught English or squash. But when I got here, I that English didn't work. Teaching English was not really didn't work well for me. So, and teaching squash, I had to go through so many courses in order to be able to be an instructor. At one point I had only $2.50 left in my pocket. And that's when I actually decided I wanted to start a business. The reason the business came up is because I was buying this newspaper from this Korean convenience store to look for a job. And I had a hard time finding a job. Everybody wanted experience and I had none. And good jobs, if I wanted to actually have a decent life, I had to have diplomas, and I had to have this experience and all that. And I had none. I had no skill whatsoever. So one day I asked this Korean guy, hey, how long you been here? He says, well, for 20 or so years, do you make money? He says, yeah. I says, how did you start? And I ask him all this question. He tells me, this is how I started. This is how I make money. I send my children to school. And then I said, how much is it worth it now? He said, well, it's worth about $200,000. I said, hey, my God, well, you've been working for 20 years. Why don't you sell it and do another business? He says, nah, this is it. That's how I said, well, that's it then. I want to do business. So, again, just like you said, thinking out of the box, with $2.50 in my pocket, I told people that I want to start a business. Everybody laughed at me. Okay, come on, go get a job, But I, from that point on, I was going to this Korean place, Korean convenience store, this guy, and I was looking at the newspaper. Now I was looking for the business section, businesses for sale. And I realized that I could buy a business for $10,000, for, $20,000. And for the next year or so, I eventually did get a job, and I saved about $13,000. And I bought my first convenience store for $20,000, and I paid $10,000 in VTB of $10,000. I realized that when I bought that business, it was losing money. I knew it was losing money. That's why it was only $20,000 with all the stock and stuff. But I had ideas, because the thing that mattered to me is that there's a lot of traffic and this guy is not making money. That's crazy. And I knew what he was doing wrong. So, and I bought that business, and I turned it around. I sold it in 9 months. I sold it for $169,000. I quadrupled the revenue. And I bought a bakery. I sold that bakery for three times as much. Then I bought a motel for $700,000, and I sold that for $1.4 million. And that's how my business life started.
Wow, that's quite the evolution there is for in the business world for you. So, Mehdi, there's probably a lot of people out there just wondering, with the way things are in business right now, just to run a business, it's really tough times economically with, inflation, staffing shortages going on, many macro factors out of their hands. I just wonder, is there anything in particular that you could advise people just to say, hey, this is one way or a couple of tips that you might have to find traction to get that success that you were able to achieve?
Well, that's where, again, just like I said before, I don't want to jump ahead, but that's why the book Five Laws of Finite Change is all about. A lot of people go try to get into a business, right, without any business experience. The inside world, they believe in poverty and scarcity, and they don't believe in what they believe. They consciously want to do something. Unconsciously, they believe otherwise, but they don't know that. So they don't know how the mind works. So when you consciously believe, think that you can actually make it, you have no idea what's going on in your subconscious mind, because at that time, that's what you see. That's how you feel. You go into business. There's always a way, Ben. I don't care what situation you're in. There's always a way out. If you cannot find it, it doesn't mean there is not a way. It means you're looking at the wrong places. But there is always a way out. If you have competitors who are doing better than you are, that's very telling. There is a way. That's why that your competitor is a successful one or succeeding. It's hard to actually just, put everything in a nutshell and tell me, oh, this is what you need to do. If you want to do anything in life, unless you go deep inside you and find out what is in there and create an inner change first, you can never create an outer change. If you try to create an outer change without the inner change first, eventually you keep struggling and come back what you were before, because that's what is inside you. And that's what will always drag you back into where you were.
Thanks for sharing, Mehdi. Those are some good points there. So when you were, doing all your business work and, transitioning from business to business, it's probably just a way of being. You didn't think anything of it. But I guess after some time, you decided to write these books, and that the book that you were just mentioning, like, what is the inspiration for you writing the book? Because like I said, you were, it kind of, it's instinctual for you to do what you do to succeed, but for some people it's not. So was it a way that you could, you know, get all your ideas together that you've acquired and then help other people that were having challenges and to kind of help lift them up by sharing your knowledge? Was that the reason you kind of got into the book writing?
Yeah, no, that's true. That's exactly right. And I got into a merchant acquisition business. So I opened a merchant acquisition firm. As we dealt with the small business, $5 to $30 million business. So, and we also created business plans. And when people came to me and wanted a business plan, before taking their money and making a business plan for them or ask them any question, I was really interested in knowing what is in their inner world. And I would interview them and ask them about their past, ask them about their childhood, ask them about believing the money, ask them about their parents and all that. And I would say about 99% of people who came to me, I said, I'm sorry, I'm not going to write you a business plan because, you know, unless you do this and that. Well, how long is this and that is going to take me? They would ask. And I said, well, about a year or two before you actually start a business plan, you need to apply these 5 laws of inner change. Create an inner change. It's going to take you about 2 years in order to create a change, and then think about starting a business. And everybody would just look at me and says, you're crazy. And they would go. And some, and most of it that I know that who started the business failed. And some of them would come back to me and says, okay, now what? And that's how I said, okay, well, let me try to do something. Let me see what, you know, how can I put it into a practice, you know, create a sort of principles or something that people could follow. And I keep practicing this 5 laws of inner change. And for years, for about maybe 15 years, I've been teaching it to people. And when we had this merger and acquisition firm, before we packaged the business for merger or acquisition, we would go in there and create a lot of management changes. And the best change that we could make is create an interchange first. And we would try to empower the employees, the management and all that. And I keep practicing and start putting them into writing. Never actually thought of a book, but I just wanted to write it down for myself.
Thanks for sharing, Mehdi. So, you know, while you were, you know, mentioning your book there, I thought kind of crossed my mind. I was wondering, like, the inner change, it's so key for a lot of things we do. And I talked a lot about that on some previous podcast episodes. And I guess for a lot of people, it's one of the challenges is to have the inner change to, you know, maybe accept that, you know, the facts on the ground have changed in terms of, let's say, the business world. So if you were, let's say, a store owner, and we have Amazon, you know, big box stores just coming in and, you know, just taking market share. And those are facts, undeniable facts. And those are big time challenges to and competitors to your business, let's say, as a small business, a small shop owner. When these circumstances happen, does that mean that we have to change internally to say, hey, maybe the business that I'm doing needs to really transform how we do it? Or maybe it's time for me to transition to a new business? Because how difficult are those conversations with some of the people that you have worked with? Because, you know, the facts on the ground change, then so should ourselves internally and our thinking, should it not?
Definitely. You need to, a lot of businesses that goes down is that because they have never asked themselves the question, okay, how can I evolve? How can my business evolve? Because their business was doing good and paid the bills, and they were content with that. And that was the worst case scenario for a lot of, that's the worst decision you could make, you know, when you are in business. You never stay in one position. You constantly have to evolve. You have to always look around you. You always have to ask yourself question, how can I do better? How can I do better? Look around you. But unfortunately, a lot of people are not doing it because they're inside them, the belief still exists that, okay, as long as I can pay the bills, pay the employees, I'm good. Why should I need change? Because change is always scary because you have to step into the unknown. So unfortunately, a lot of people never ask questions. And just the other day, I was at the shopping mall just waiting for my kids to go shopping. And I was looking in front of me. There was this store. I was there for about 3 hours or so. Not one single customer walked in that store. I couldn't help myself but talking to the owner because that poor guy was just sitting there and standing and walking, looking at the phone. And I told him, I asked him, how long you've been in business? As well, just a few months. I said, what are you doing to improve your sale? He says, what do you mean? I says, what are you doing? He says, well, it's a mall. You know, I just people walk around and I'm waiting for them to come. Well, is it working out for you? He says, no. I says, well, then you got to think beyond people who are walking in the mall. Think about, he says, what can I do? I says, I really don't know what you can do. It's your business. I'm not in this industry. Are there other people who are successful? Yeah. Are there some online businesses who are successful? Yeah. Have you ever thought about it? No. Well, there's a homework for you then. Go think about it. What else you can do? Can you actually ship some merchandise from here somewhere else? Do you have a website that can sell online stuff and all that? No. So, you know what I mean? So a lot of people, unfortunately, never ask the questions. Just like you said, you have to create an interchange. You have to understand that consciously you could want anything. To subconscious mind, it has no value whatsoever. It has a very temporary value. So people, when consciously they decide they want something and they get excited and they go act upon it. And because the subconscious mind never says no to you. If you say, I want to do a business, consciously you believe in it. Your subconscious mind says, yeah, why not? Let's go. It not just says, let's go. It tries to encourage you to do that. And it creates stories for you. Yeah, you have a big store. You have a successful business. You have even at your dream at night, if it comes in your dreams, it is trying to encourage you to do that. It's not the subconscious mind that gets you in trouble. It's you who get yourself in trouble. And let's say, you know, you're all excited and you open a shop and first month you didn't pay the bill and you said, it's okay. It's going to take me 2 months. And the second month you don't have enough money to pay the rent. And all of a sudden you tell your mind, oh my God, I'm screwed. And your mind never says no. It says, yes, you are. Yeah. What are you going to do next month? What are you going to do with this? And then you are at the mercy of your subconscious mind and old beliefs that is what is inside you. And it'll start dictating everything you do, every decision you make, every thought you have, it starts dictating you. Whatever is inside you is now in control. And there's no escape.
Those are some good insights there, Mehdi. So, you know, through your experiences, like with your own businesses and helping others, would it be fair to say that probably attitude is everything, the evolution of, you know, how you're doing things and assessing the business landscape, the environment, like that's like half the battle. It's just like, just to, you know, have that critical analysis, critical thoughts with the process and also get that contrasting opinion. So hear people, you know, let people tell you that, hey, you know what, the environment has changed and you've got to get that feedback instead of staying in your environment where like everything you think everything's fine. Like you want to constantly hear things that challenge your beliefs so then you can evolve, because everything else is going to evolve whether you do it or not.
The biggest problem that most of us have is we have no idea how the mind works. It's as simple as that. We have no idea how the mind works. I'm sure you agree with me. The mind is behind everything. Behind how you feel, if you're happy, you're sad, you're depressed, you know, you have fear, you're successful, you're unsuccessful. Your mind is behind everything, your health. But who teaches us about our mind? Who teaches about the mind? Nobody. Nobody teaches how the mind works. We pick up as we go. And who do we pick it up from? From people around us who have their own challenges. And that's the problem. That's the problem. It doesn't matter how you try, how hard you try to do something, I'm going to resist this, I'm going to do this no matter what. It is not going to work. You know, people who are successful, let's say financially, that's what matters nowadays. Everybody looking at you know, financial success is the only success. That's how they're considered. Let's say financially. People who are financially successful, all those billionaires, they loved what they were doing. They were passionate at what they were doing. They were not working hard. When we hear Elon Musk works 18 hours a day, oh my God, I cannot work 1 hour a day. I hate when I go to work. 1 hour is like a day for me. How does he do that? But we don't understand that, no, he was passionate about what he was doing and what he is doing. Why? I'm not saying that, oh, he knows everything about the mind. I don't know, maybe he does. But he practiced the five laws of interchange. It is not my laws, by the way. You know, somebody said, ha, who are you to change? It's not my law, it's a law. I don't care who, you break it, you see what happens. You break it, you see what happens. For example, the law of complete says you have to complete yourself. You have to complete everything you start. And you have to know, first of all, that you are complete. You are complete. You have all the answers for all your problems. You have it. You're complete. For example, Elon Musk, which I have his book right here. Elon Musk, that's why I talk about Elon Musk. So when he wanted to do something, he never gave up. Never. He wanted to complete it. How? He didn't care. He says, I'll find a way. Did people laugh at him? Everybody laughed at him. He wanted to start a car and get into a car business. Every other car manufacturer was laughing at him. But he did it. Why? Because he did complete everything he started. Why? Because he believed in himself. He believed in himself. Okay. And the law of belief, you know, and one of the most important laws is the law of discover and accept. You have to discover your past. You have to discover what's inside you. You want to go make money? You have to discover your belief about money. I don't care what you believe today. What did your parents believe? What did your siblings believe? When you were young, what did you believe about it? That's important. You have to discover that. If you don't, if you act upon your conscious mind only, if you break this law, you will suffer the consequences. Just like 95%, 94% of businesses that opens closes. Why? Because consciously they believe they're going to make it. But subconsciously, they're in their inner world. It's a totally different story. It will drag them back where they were because there was no change in there. All your outer world change is the reflection of your inner world. No more, no less. If that's the case, you have to change your inner world. It will automatically change your outer world. And that's the big problem. We don't know how the mind works. And these five laws of inner change will help you take a grasp, at least the basic understanding of how this mind works.
Thanks again for your insights there, Mehdi, on your book and how people should kind of evolve on their businesses and some of their habits and approaches. I think that's really helpful information. So let's pivot to your other project that you've been working on over the years. It's with this organization called the Organization for Work and Development of Afghanistan. I wonder if you could tell us the story behind this organization and the work you've done.
Ben, I kind of lived the life I wanted to, right? I traveled the world, you know, make money. I made money, you know, I didn't make billions, but I did make millions, you know, had the waterfront house, had the boat, all the toys you wanted. Then sometimes you ask yourself a question, you know, what? So what? Now what? And that's when I decided to use the money to help others. And since I was born in Afghanistan, and I believe that it was best to go back home and trying to help people like myself when I was a child. There was no school in my village. In 2005, I realized that there was still no school in the village that I was born. And people had to, the children had to walk about an hour and a half one way to just go to school. And in 2005, I went in Afghanistan and built my first school. And from there, I just kept building schools here and there, whatever I thought it was necessary. In 2016 or 2017, I decided to go myself, go in Afghanistan. Before, I would just travel and go build schools and just, or at least for the opening ceremony, and I would come back. But this time, I just actually wanted to go in Afghanistan and see what I can do myself. And that's how, where I opened this NGO, non-profit organization, Organization for Work and Development in Afghanistan. Initially, my plan was to help students use the five laws of inner change and try to understand life a little bit better, trying to help them understand how the mind works. I believe that it is really, really important for us from the very young age to know how the mind works. And it is really important for us to feed the young children the positive stuff that they could use in their life in the future. And when I went to Afghanistan, I started working with universities, but at the same time I realized that there were a lot of orphans, kids working, you know, 5, 6 year old, 10 year old kids working on the streets and on all that. And I changed my focus to trying to help the orphan and underprivileged children. And I did realize that most of those children never saw school. And then that's was my the major project that I had to find the orphans and find out how we can help them go to school instead of working on the street. So we found them families, for example. We paid some families who would take them in and to take care of them and send them to school. So we had about 431 orphans all together. We're trying to help them with their school, not just school and other activities as well. So they were involved in so many other activities that we believe they're really important for their future, for a successful future.
Yeah, thanks for the context there, Mehdi. So, with all the work that you've done thus far there, you funded most of these operations on your own. I'm just wondering, how you went about doing that.
Yes, I did find it most of it myself. One of the biggest problems that, for example, countries like Afghanistan have is that there is so much money going in the country for, as a donation. For example, the United States has spent billions and billions of dollars trying to help Afghans, for example. When I went there, I realized that that money was creating even more problem than actually solved. Most people in Afghanistan were so used to handouts that they wouldn't do anything. They would always wait for an NGO to come and do something for them, or a government funding to come and do something for them. That's when I tried to get funds for my projects. Because my projects were, I would never hand people out money, And I would have proposals to other NGOs or even if to other governments, says, okay, if you give me this much money, if you have a plan to create, to plant, for example, 1 million trees, which one of the NGOs from Italy wanted to do. And I said, okay, have you ever thought about creating an interchange first, making people ready first before you put the trees? He says, no. I says, the trees will not succeed. You won't see the 1 million tree next year, I'll tell you that. But they did anyways. And they saw the result that the next year there was half the trees were gone. The following year there was no trees left. Okay, because people didn't care about the trees because it was free. And I kept telling them, let's have conditions. You want to help this family, have something to do for this family and then pay them. Have this community, for example, this like 100 houses in this settlement, have a plan for them to build their own roads and then pay them money. Tell them to go build septic tanks for themselves and then pay them money. You know, not just go build for them. So because my approach was different, so unfortunately nobody funded me, so I funded myself.
Yeah, that's those are some great thoughts. That's such a great story as well, Mehdi. So yeah, you talked about, you know, international community looking to do donations to Afghans, and obviously the United States had a presence there. I guess in your mind, it didn't sound like that was giving handouts was the best solutions. We need to look at giving hand ups.
Yeah.
But I guess looking back, I mean, with everything that's happened in Afghanistan, and then last year, the international community basically abruptly leaving Afghanistan, I'm just curious to get your thoughts. Like, is it net positive or is it net negative or about the same? Like where Afghanistan is in their development as a country, like before any of this foreign aid and intervention occurred in your mind, because obviously you grew up there, 70s and the 80s, totally different time there, but, or maybe not. So I'm just wondering, like, are we better off for everything that has happened over the years?
You know, when we think of the big powers, right? When we think of a big powers, we believe that they have everything figured out. But unfortunately, this is not the case. If you look at a small family, that's how exactly governments are run. If you have a terrible dad or an angry dad, you could have an angry president who would do the same damage, you know, to the country and to the world as a angry or frustrated dad would do to the children and the family. It's no difference. It's no difference. We're a messed up animal in this world. You know, we don't think about well-being of each other. We don't. It is all what we have learned. And as a child, you know, I am better. You know, everybody has to listen to me. I'm always right. What is good for me? Who cares about your neighbor? That's the exact same approach in the world nowadays. Who cares? And they go to Afghanistan, not for Afghanistan. It's not for Afghans. They had their own whatever. You know, I don't want to even get into details. It's so pathetic. You know, that people, human being, can do stuff to other human being. You know, just human rights and helping other people are just a tool. That's how I see, and that's how my experience tells me. That's really, really unfortunate. Just imagine, Ben. Imagine for a minute that all these wars and killings and hatred and poverty. How come? Don't we have the technology to feed everybody in the world? Aren't we smart enough at least to know that war is bad, killing someone is not good, but we don't care. We don't care. That's how I see the world. The more power you have in this world, the more responsibility you have this world to take care of everybody else. But unfortunately, I'm sure you will agree that it's the opposite. The more power a country has, the more damage it does to the rest of the world. It's the opposite. We're going the opposite direction. And Afghanistan is just another victim. And Afghans are just another victim. You ask if we're well off, if the Afghans are well off. We're back in square one, let's put it that way. After 20 years of misleading the Afghans, they put us back where we were. Okay, so how could you leave? How could you? I was there. I escaped just before the Taliban take over. And how can you promise millions of Afghans that you're there to help them, truly help them, and all of a sudden hand them to the people you believe are the terrorists? And you just hand everybody back to them. You have no idea what is going on in Afghanistan. I'm sure you know now the women are not allowed to work anymore. You know how many widows are there, because they lost their husband and they were the only breadwinners of the family. And now because of the Taliban, because they handed this government back to the Taliban, they're not allowed to work. I can only imagine what is going on in their family. How are they going to feed their family? Girls are not allowed to go to school. They're not allowed to go to university. They're not allowed to work, for God's sake. And this is the Afghanistan they left.
Thanks for your candid comments, Mehdi. Yeah, I largely agree with you there. It does sound like we're back to square one. So it's unfortunate, there's different powers that be that have different interests, and they have a different plan for Afghanistan than people there that want progress. And I guess the next question for you is, like, how does Afghanistan evolve and get better given current circumstances? Does it come down to people like you, like-minded people like you, to do that outreach and kind of piece together what they can given the political climate that exists there, and try to do these little things to give people hand ups, not handouts, because obviously handouts didn't work and they went to the wrong people, but maybe it's just working on the hand ups and kind of picking your spots and going from there.
I believe that if we only take care of ourselves, everything will be fine. If we only find our true self, everything will be fine. The minute we try to dictate other people, trying to change other people, everybody's in trouble. As a human being, if you find your true self, just like somebody asked me and says, "I don't know who am I?" I said, "Well, I don't know who you are, but this is what I know: you are intelligent beyond imagination. You're kind. You're loving. You're caring. That's your true self." If everybody finds their true self, there's no frustration, there's no anger, there's no hatred, there's no war. That is the problem. We always try to poke other people all the time to change. Why? Because I don't feel comfortable. And now think of it collectively. Now we collectively do that. A country do that to another country, A nation do that to another nation. You do like that. Why? Because that's my way. No, take care of yourself. Take care of your own people. That's the best way to go forward. Will there be in Afghanistan? I am sure there are a lot of people suffering. But as long as people start learning about themselves, the environment will slowly change. But unfortunately, we have never started. So the worst is yet to come.
Well, I hope not, but it's tough circumstances out there for sure, Amedi. So you mentioned education, and education is something that I think everybody should, that should be like a lifelong goal for everyone. And I think everyone needs to learn what really are the causes of the situation in Afghanistan. And education, again, just to circle back to the project that you were working with, the ODA organization. So from what I understand, because of the current circumstances, the work there is kind of put on hold, but the mission isn't going to stop. So Mehdi, I was wondering if you can just share with us, like, what are your plans going forward with the organization and some of your other pursuits in Afghanistan to help people out there?
Well, unfortunately, when the Taliban took over, they ransacked our office and, you know, took all our computers and cameras and everything we had. They arrested our staff, tortured them. It was terrible for the, especially the first few months. Now we just started getting back, and some of the staff are talking to the Taliban, trying to make them understand what we wanted to do. And they're opening up a little bit. I don't know what it'll lead, but I'm in constant contact with people there, hoping that find a way or a compromise the Taliban that they could help us or allow us at least to do what we did, you know, just helping people. I don't know the time frame. It's hard to say because no government in the world, no country has recognized Taliban as a government yet. So it is hard to say when and or to put a time frame. And Ben, sorry about, I just wanted to mention about, you mentioned about education. You know, I just hope that one day they will teach children how the mind works, you know, not necessarily tell them how the mind works. They should find a way for them to start learning how this thing works, because you learn everything till about 7 to 10 years old. Like, let's say by the time you're 10, you're done. Whatever you needed to know, you already know. And from there on, your subconscious mind controls you. So it is really crucial for that first 10 years of our life to not just teach about, let's go get a job, money, let's go get money, big house, big car. No, teach them about life. Teach them about happiness. Teach them about family. Teach them about love and kindness. You know, have that kind of plan. Have that kind of program. And that's what I'm hoping, hopefully, in the future, the education, it'll be part of our education system.
Thanks for the share there, Mehdi. Yeah, it's great to, you know, leave the Afghanistan topic on a positive note. So hopefully the Taliban, they'll kind of, you know, see what you're doing there, and that's providing some positive impacts, and maybe one day you can kind of get back at your work there, or maybe in a different way. And some of your insights there about education abroad for all of us here. So on that note, I just wondered, you know, with all your experience and, you know, the books you've written, all that knowledge there, like, for people that are kind of stuck in a rut, what is maybe like the top thing they can do right now to kind of shake themselves, you know, out of that rut, to do better at their business, better at their job, whatever they're doing in life? Like, what's maybe the number one thing that they can do right now to kind of move the conversation forward for themselves?
I think that's a great question. Always know, tell yourself that wherever I am is because of my own action, however good or bad, because of my own decisions, because what I have learned. It has nothing to do with anybody else. It is me who brought me here. It is me who frustrated me. It is me who stresses me out, nobody else. And this will give you power. It means that if you did it yourself, you can undo it. Then if you believe that you caused the whole thing, it means that you have power. The minute you blame other people, you lose power. You have no power. Then other people have power. That's what you're trying to tell me. Other people have power. How you feel, how you, your life is going to be, you know. So that's, I think, if people will just do that, look inside and find out the reason why they're there, they'll find the reasons and the ways to get out of that problem. Always.
Thanks, Mehdi. Those are some great words to leave us off with today. So as we kind of come near to the end of this podcast, I'd like to ask my guests a two-part question. And it goes like this. What are you most grateful for? And what are you most looking forward to in the future?
Ben, it's been a long time teaching myself to see what is happening right now and appreciate what is happening right now. And I only have a vision for the future. I don't consider it a goal, because if it's a goal, I'm going to be in trouble if I tell my mind my goal is 2 years from now. I'm always looking forward to completing the task that I have right now. That's the only thing that I'm looking forward to. And I'm always grateful that I'm able to complete the task that I have right now. Always, constantly telling myself, what is the best place for me right now? What is the best thing for me to do right now? What I'm doing right now. What is the most important thing for me to do right now in the world? What I'm doing right now. And that's what I'm always looking forward to. Complete everything I start.
That's terrific, Mehdi. I love how concise that is and focus. So yeah, Mehdi, I think we're kind of wrapping up here. So if people want to know more about you, where can they find you?
Well, Ben, you know, fortunately or unfortunately, I'm an introvert. So I don't try to, you know, promote myself, you know, run around, do stuff. And I don't do a lot of those stuff. But if somebody want to find me, I'm sure they can go on your website. I'm sure you have a link there for my book and to contact me. Or if you do that, I'll really appreciate it. And I know you do. But other than that, if you they visit ODA, ODA.ca, and they can find me through that website.
Excellent. Yeah, thanks, Mehdi. Yeah, we'll be sure to add that to our show notes. So that's a wrap for episode 10. Thanks for joining us, and namaste, everyone.